When he noticed her again, he realized that the vision of her profile was in his own mind, because she was turned to him full face, watching him. In the sudden instant of returning to reality, he thought that what he saw in her eyes was enjoyment. But in the next instant, he reminded himself that he was sane, and that this was not possible. "It's the first time you've invited that," he used an obscene word with unemotional precision, "to my house. It's the last."
"How dare you use such—"
"Don't argue, Lillian. If you do, I'll throw him out right now." He gave her a moment to answer, to object, to scream at him if she wished. She remained silent, not looking at him. Only her smooth cheeks seemed faintly drawn inward, as if deflated. Moving blindly away through the coils of lights, voices, and perfume, he felt a cold touch of dread. He knew that he should think of Lillian and find the answer to the riddle of her character, because this was a revelation which he could not ignore. But he did not think of her. And he felt the dread because he knew that the answer had ceased to matter to him long ago. The flood of weariness was starting to rise again. He felt as if he could almost see it in thickening waves. It was not within him, but outside, spreading through the room. For an instant he felt as if he were alone, lost in a gray desert, needing help, and knowing that no help would come. He stopped short. In the lighted doorway, the length of the room between them, he saw the tall, arrogant figure of a man who had paused for a moment before entering. He had never met the man, but of all the notorious faces that cluttered the pages of newspapers, this was the one he despised. It was Francisco d'Ancona. Reardon had never given much thought to men like Bertram Scudder, but with every hour of his life, with the strain and the pride of every moment when his muscles or his mind had ached from effort, with every step he had taken to rise out of the mines of Minnesota and to turn his effort into gold, with all of his profound respect for money and for its meaning, he despised the squanderer who did not know how to deserve the great gift of inherited wealth. There, he thought, was the most contemptible representative of the species. He saw Francisco d'Ancona enter, bow to Lillian, then walk into the crowd as if he owned the room which he had never entered before. Heads turned to watch him, as if he pulled them on strings in his wake. Approaching Lillian once more, Reardon said without anger, the contempt becoming amusement in his voice, "I didn't know you knew that one."
"I've met him in a few parties."
"Is he one of your friends, too?"
"Certainly not."
The sharp resentment was genuine. "Then why did you invite him?"
"Well, you can't give a party, not a party that counts, while he's in this country without inviting him. It's a nuisance if he comes, and a social black mark if he doesn't."
Reardon laughed. She was off guard. She did not usually admit things of this kind. "Look," he said wearily, "I don't want to spoil your party, but keep that man away from me. Don't come around with introductions. I don't want to meet him. I don't know how you'll work that, but you're an expert hostess, so work it." Dagny stood still when she saw Francisco approaching. He bowed to her as he passed by. He did not stop, but she knew that he had stopped the moment in his mind. She saw him smile faintly in deliberate emphasis of what he understood and did not choose to acknowledge. She turned away. She hoped to avoid him for the rest of the evening. Balfe Eubank had joined the group around Dr. Pritchett and was saying sullenly, "No, you cannot expect people to understand the higher reaches of philosophy. Culture should be taken out of the hands of the dollar chasers. We need a national subsidy for literature. It is disgraceful that artists are treated like peddlers, and that artworks have to be sold like soap."
"You mean your complaint is that they don't sell like soap?" asked Francisco d'Ancona.
They had not noticed him approach. The conversation stopped, as if slashed off. Most of them had never met him, but they all recognized him at once.
"I meant—"
Balfe Eubank started angrily and closed his mouth. He saw the eager interest on the faces of his audience, but it was not interest in philosophy any longer. "Why, hello, Professor," said Francisco, bowing to Dr. Pritchett. There was no pleasure in Dr. Pritchett's face when he answered the greeting and performed a few introductions.
"We were just discussing a most interesting subject," said the earnest matron. Dr. Pritchett was telling us that nothing is anything. He should undoubtedly know more than anyone else about that, Francisco answered gravely.
I wouldn't have supposed that you knew Dr. Pritchett so well, Signor Danconia, she said, and wondered why the professor looked displeased by her remark.
I am an alumnus of the great school that employs Dr. Pritchett at present, the Patrick Henry University, but I studied under one of his predecessors, Hugh Axton.
Hugh Axton?
The attractive young woman gasped.
But you couldn't have, Signor Danconia. You're not old enough. I thought he was one of those great names of the last century.
Perhaps in spirit, madam, not in fact.
But I thought he died years ago.
Why, no, he's still alive.
Then why don't we ever hear about him any more?
He retired 9 years ago.
Isn't it odd? When a politician or a movie star retires, we read front-page stories about it. But when a philosopher retires, people do not even notice it.
They do, eventually. A young man said, astonished, I thought Hugh Axton was one of those classics that nobody studied anymore except in histories of philosophy. I read an article recently which referred to him as the last of the great advocates of reason.
Just what did Hugh Axton teach? Asked the earnest matron.
Francisco answered, he taught that everything is something.
Your loyalty to your teacher is laudable, Signor Danconia, said Dr. Pritchett dryly. May we take it that you are an example of the practical results of his teaching?
I am. James Taggart had approached the group and was waiting to be noticed.
Hello, Francisco.
Good evening, James.
What a wonderful coincidence seeing you here.
I've been very anxious to speak to you.
That's new.
You haven't always been.
Now you're choking, just like in the old days.
Taggart was moving slowly, as if casually, away from the group, hoping to draw Francisco after him.
You know that there's not a person in this room who wouldn't love to talk to you.
Really?
I'd be inclined to suspect the opposite.
Francisco had followed obediently, but stopped within hearing distance of the others.
I have tried in every possible way to get in touch with you, said Taggart, but circumstances didn't permit me to succeed.
Are you trying to hide from me the fact that I refused to see you?
Well, that is, I mean, why did you refuse?
I couldn't imagine what you wanted to speak to me about.
The San Sebastian mines, of course.
Taggart's voice rose a little.
Why, what about them?
But, now look, Francisco, this is serious. It's a disaster, an unprecedented disaster, and nobody can make any sense out of it. I don't know what to think. I don't understand it at all. I have a right to know.
A right?
Aren't you being old-fashioned, James? But what is it you want to know?
Well, first of all, that nationalization. What are you going to do about it?
Nothing.
Nothing?
But surely you don't want me to do anything about it. My mines and your railroad were seized by the will of the people. You wouldn't want me to oppose the will of the people, would you?
Francisco, this is not a laughing matter.
I never thought it was.
I'm entitled to an explanation. You owe your stockholders an account of the whole disgraceful affair. Why did you pick a worthless mine? Why did you waste all those millions? What sort of rotten swindle was it?
Francisco stood looking at him in polite astonishment. Why, James, he said, I thought you would approve of it.
Approve?
I thought you would consider the San Sebastian mines as the practical realization of an ideal of the highest moral order. Remembering that you and I have disagreed so often in the past, I thought you would be gratified to see me acting in accordance with your principles.
What are you talking about?
Francisco shook his head regretfully. I don't know why you should call my behavior rotten. I thought you would recognize it as an honest effort to practice what the whole world is preaching. Doesn't everyone believe that it is evil to be selfish? I was totally selfless in regard to the San Sebastian project. Isn't it evil to pursue a personal interest? I had no personal interest in it whatever. Isn't it evil to work for profit? I did not work for profit. I took a loss. Doesn't everyone agree that the purpose and justification of an industrial enterprise are not production, but the livelihood of its employees? The San Sebastian mines were the most eminently successful venture in industrial history. They produced no copper,
but they provided a livelihood for thousands of men who could not have achieved in a lifetime the equivalent of what they got for one day's work, which they could not do. Isn't it generally agreed that an owner is a parasite and an exploiter, that it is the employees who do all the work and make the product possible? I did not exploit anyone. I did not burden the San Sebastian mines with my useless presence. I left them in the hands of the men who count. I did not pass judgment on the value of that property. I turned it over to a mining specialist. He was not a very good specialist, but he needed the job very badly. Isn't it generally conceded that when you hire a man for a job, it is his need that counts, not his ability? Doesn't everyone believe that in order to get the goods, all you have to do is need them? I've carried out every moral precept of our age. I expected gratitude and a citation of honor. I do not understand why I'm being damned. In the silence of those who had listened, the sole comment was the shrill, sudden giggle of Betty Pope. She had understood nothing, but she saw the look of helpless fury on James Taggart's face. People were looking at Taggart, expecting an answer. They were indifferent to the issue. They were merely amused by the spectacle of someone's embarrassment. Taggart achieved a patronizing smile. "You don't expect me to take this seriously?" he asked. "There was a time," Francisco answered, "when I did not believe that anyone could take it seriously. I was wrong." "This is outrageous!" Taggart's voice started to rise. "It's perfectly outrageous to treat your public responsibilities with such thoughtless levity." He turned to hurry away. Francisco shrugged, spreading his hands. "You see, I didn't think you wanted to speak to me." Reardon stood alone far at the other end of the room. Philip noticed him, approached, and waved to Lillian, calling her over. "Lillian, I don't think that Henry is having a good time," he said, smiling. One could not tell whether the mockery of his smile was directed at Lillian or at Reardon. "Can't we do something about it?" "Oh, nonsense," said Reardon. "I wish I knew what to do about it, Philip," said Lillian. "I've always wished Henry would learn to relax. He's so grimly serious about everything. He's such a rigid Puritan. I've always wanted to see him drunk, just once. But I've given up. What would you suggest?"
"Oh, I don't know. But he shouldn't be standing around all by himself."
"Drop it," said Reardon. While thinking dimly that he did not want to hurt their feelings, he could not prevent himself from adding, "You don't know how hard I've tried to be left standing all by myself."
"There, you see?"
Lillian smiled at Philip.
"To enjoy life and people is not so simple as pouring a ton of steel. Intellectual pursuits are not learned in the marketplace."
Philip chuckled.
"It's not intellectual pursuits I'm worried about."
"How sure are you about that Puritan stuff, Lillian? If I were you, I wouldn't leave him free to look around. There are too many beautiful women here tonight."
"Henry entertaining thoughts of infidelity? You flatter him, Philip. You overestimate his courage."
She smiled at Reardon coldly for a brief, stressed moment, then moved away. Reardon looked at his brother. "What in hell do you think you're doing?" "Oh, stop playing the Puritan. Can't you take a joke?" Moving aimlessly through the crowd, Dagny wondered why she had accepted the invitation to this party. The answer astonished her. It was because she had wanted to see Hank Reardon. Watching him in the crowd, she realized the contrast for the first time. The faces of the others looked like aggregates of interchangeable features, every face oozing to blend into the anonymity of resembling all, and all looking as if they were melting. Reardon's face, with the sharp planes, the pale blue eyes, the ash-blonde hair, had the firmness of ice. The uncompromising clarity of its lines made it look, among the others, as if he were moving through a fog, hit by a ray of light. Her eyes kept returning to him involuntarily. She never caught him glancing in her direction. She could not believe that he was avoiding her intentionally. There could be no possible reason for it. Yet she felt certain that he was. She wanted to approach him and convince herself that she was mistaken. Something stopped her. She could not understand her own reluctance. Reardon bore patiently a conversation with his mother and two ladies whom she wished him to entertain with stories of his youth and his struggle. He complied, telling himself that she was proud of him in her own way. but he felt as if something in her manner kept suggesting that she had nursed him through his struggle, and that she was the source of his success. He was glad when she let him go. Then he escaped once more to the recess of the window. He stood there for a while, leaning on a sense of privacy, as if it were a physical support. "Mr. Reardon," said a strangely quiet voice beside him. "Permit me to introduce myself. My name is Dunconia." Reardon turned, startled. Dunconia's manner and voice had a quality he had seldom encountered before, a tone of authentic respect. "How do you do?" he answered. His voice was brusque and dry, but he had answered. "I have observed that Mrs. Reardon has been trying to avoid the necessity of presenting me to you, and I can guess the reason. Would you prefer that I leave your house?" The action of naming an issue instead of evading it was so unlike the usual behavior of all the men he knew, it was such a sudden, startling relief, that Reardon remained silent for a moment, studying Dunconia's face. Francisco had said it very simply, neither as a reproach nor a plea, but in a manner which, strangely, acknowledged Reardon's dignity and his own. "No," said Reardon. "Whatever else you guessed, I did not say that." "Thank you. In that case, you will allow me to speak to you." "Why should you wish to speak to me? My motives cannot interest you at present." "Mine is not the sort of conversation that could interest you at all. You are mistaken about one of us, Mr. Reardon, or both. I came to this party solely in order to meet you." There had been a faint tone of amusement in Reardon's voice. Now it hardened into a hint of contempt. "You started by playing it straight. Stick to it." "I am." "What did you want to meet me for? In order to make me lose money?" Francisco looked straight at him. "Yes, eventually. What is it this time, a gold mine?" Francisco shook his head slowly. The conscious deliberation of the movement gave it an air that was almost sadness. "No," he said. "I don't want to sell you anything. As a matter of fact, I did not attempt to sell the copper mine to James Taggart either. He came to me for it. You won't." Reardon chuckled. "If you understand that much, we have at least a sensible basis for conversation. Proceed on that. If you don't have some fancy investment in mind, what did you want to meet me for?" "In order to become acquainted with you?" "That's not an answer. It's just another way of saying the same thing." "Not quite, Mr. Reardon." "Unless you mean, in order to gain my confidence?" "No. I don't like people who speak or think in terms of gaining anybody's confidence. If one's actions are honest, one does not need the predated confidence of others, only their rational perception. The person who craves a moral blank check of that kind has dishonest intentions, whether he admits it to himself or not." Reardon's startled glance at him was like the involuntary thrust of a hand grasping for support in a desperate need. The glance betrayed how much he wanted to find the sort of man he thought he was seeing. Then Reardon lowered his eyes, almost closing them slowly, shutting out the vision and the need. His face was hard. It had an expression of severity, an inner severity directed at himself. It looked austere and lonely. "All right," he said tonelessly. "What do you want, if it's not my confidence?" "I want to learn to understand you." "What for?" "For a reason of my own which need not concern you at present." "What do you want to understand about me?" Francisco looked silently out at the darkness. The fire of the mills was dying down. There was only a faint tinge of red left on the edge of the earth, just enough to outline the scraps of clouds ripped by the tortured battle of the storm in the sky. Dim shapes kept sweeping through space and vanishing, shapes which were branches, but looked as if they were the fury of the wind made visible. "It's a terrible night for any animal caught unprotected on that plain," said Francisco Dunconia. "This is when one should appreciate the meaning of being a man." Reardon did not answer for a moment. Then he said, as if in answer to himself, a tone of wonder in his voice, "Funny."
"What?"
"You told me what I was thinking just a while ago."
"You were?"
"Only, I didn't have the words for it."
"Shall I tell you the rest of the words?"
"Go ahead."
"You stood here and watched the storm with the greatest pride one can ever feel. because you were able to have summer flowers and half-naked women in your house on a night like this, in demonstration of your victory over that storm. And if it weren't for you, most of those who are here would be left helpless at the mercy of that wind, in the middle of some such plain. How did you know that? In time with his question, Reardon realized that it was not his thoughts this man had named, but his most hidden, most personal emotion, and that he who would never confess his emotions to anyone had confessed it in his question. He saw the faintest flicker in Francisco's eyes, as of a smile or a check mark. "What would you know about a pride of that kind?" Reardon asked sharply, as if the contempt of the second question could erase the confidence of the first. "That is what I felt once, when I was young." Reardon looked at him. There was neither mockery nor self-pity in Francisco's face. The fine sculptured planes and the clear blue eyes held a quiet composure. The face was open, offered to any blow unflinching. "Why do you want to talk about it?" Reardon asked, prompted by a moment's reluctant compassion. "Let us say, by way of gratitude, Mr. Reardon."
"Gratitude to me, if you will accept it?"
Reardon's voice hardened. "I haven't asked for gratitude. I don't need it."
"I've not said you needed it. But of all those men whom you are saving from the storm tonight, I'm the only one who will offer it."
After a moment's silence, Reardon asked, his voice low with a sound which was almost a threat, "What are you trying to do?"
"I'm calling your attention to the nature of those for whom you are working."
"It would take a man who's never done an honest day's work in his life to think or say that." The contempt in Reardon's voice had a note of relief. He had been disarmed by a doubt of his judgment on the character of his adversary. Now he felt certain once more. "You wouldn't understand it if I told you that the man who works, works for himself, even if he does carry the whole wretched bunch of you along. Now I'll guess what you're thinking. Go ahead, say that it's evil, that I'm selfish, conceited, heartless, cruel." "I am. I don't want any part of that tripe about working for others. I'm not."
For the first time he saw the look of a personal reaction in Francisco's eyes, the look of something eager and young.
"The only thing that's wrong in what you said," Francisco answered, "is that you permit anyone to call it evil." In Reardon's pause of incredulous silence, he pointed at the crowd in the drawing room. "Why are you willing to carry them?"
"Because they're a bunch of miserable children who struggle to remain alive desperately and very badly, while I don't even notice the burden."
"Why don't you tell them that?"
"What?"
"That you're working for your own sake, not theirs."
"They know it."
"Oh, yes, they know it. Every single one of them here knows it. But they don't think you do. And the aim of all their efforts is to keep you from knowing it."
"Why should I care what they think?"
"Because it's a battle, in which one must make one's stand clear."
"A battle?
What battle? I hold the whip hand. I don't fight the disarmed."
"Are they?"
"They have a weapon against you. It's their only weapon, but it's a terrible one. Ask yourself what it is sometime."
"Where do you see any evidence of it?"
"In the unforgivable fact that you're as unhappy as you are." Reardon could accept any form of reproach, abuse, damnation anyone chose to throw at him. The only human reaction which he would not accept was pity. The stab of a coldly rebellious anger brought him back to the full context of the moment. He spoke, fighting not to acknowledge the nature of the emotion rising within him. "What sort of effrontery are you indulging in? What's your motive?"
"Let us say, to give you the words you need for the time when you'll need them."
"Why should you want to speak to me on such a subject?"
"In the hope that you will remember it."
What he felt, thought Reardon, was anger at the incomprehensible fact that he had allowed himself to enjoy this conversation. He felt a dim sense of betrayal, the hint of an unknown danger.
"Do you expect me to forget what you are?" he asked, knowing that this was what he had forgotten.
"I do not expect you to think of me at all." Under his anger, the emotion which Reardon would not acknowledge remained unstated and unthought. He knew it only as a hint of pain. Had he faced it, he would have known that he still heard Francisco's voice saying,
I'm the only one who will offer it, if you will accept it. He heard the words, and the strangely solemn inflection of the quiet voice, and an inexplicable answer of his own, something within him that wanted to cry yes, to accept, to tell this man that he accepted, that he needed it. Though there was no name for what he needed, it was not gratitude, and he knew that it was not gratitude this man had meant. Aloud, he said, "I didn't seek to talk to you, but you've asked for it, and you're going to hear it. To me, there's only one form of human depravity, the man without a purpose. That is true. I can forgive all those others. They're not vicious. They're merely helpless. But you, you're the kind that can't be forgiven. It's against the sin of forgiveness that I wanted to warn you. You had the greatest chance in life. What have you done with it? If you have the mind to understand all the things you said, how can you speak to me at all? How can you face anyone after the sort of irresponsible destruction you've perpetrated in that Mexican business? It is your right to condemn me for it, if you wish." Dagny stood by the corner of the window recess, listening. They did not notice her. She had seen them together, and she had approached, drawn by an impulse she could not explain or resist. It seemed crucially important that she know what these two men said to each other. She had heard their last few sentences. She had never thought it possible that she would see Francisco taking a beating. He could smash any adversary in any form of encounter. Yet he stood, offering no defense. She knew that it was not indifference. She knew his face well enough to see the effort his calm cost him. She saw the faint line of a muscle pulled tight across his cheek. "Of all those who live by the ability of others," said Reardon, "you're the one real parasite." "I have given you grounds to think so." "Then what right have you to talk about the meaning of being a man? You're the one who has betrayed it." "I am sorry if I have offended you by what you may rightly consider as a presumption." Francisco bowed and turned to go. Reardon said involuntarily, not knowing that the question negated his anger, that it was a plea to stop this man and hold him. "What did you want to learn to understand about me?" Francisco turned. The expression of his face had not changed. It was still a look of gravely courteous respect. "I have learned it," he answered. Reardon stood watching him as he walked off into the crowd. The figures of a butler with a crystal dish and of Dr. Pritchett, stooping to choose another canapé, hid Francisco from sight. Reardon glanced out at the darkness. Nothing could be seen there but the wind. Dagny stepped forward when he came out of the recess. She smiled, openly inviting conversation. He stopped. It seemed to her that he had stopped reluctantly. She spoke hastily to break the silence. "Hank, why do you have so many intellectuals of the looter persuasion here? I wouldn't have them in my house." This was not what she had wanted to say to him, but she did not know what she wanted to say. Never before had she felt herself left wordless in his presence. She saw his eyes narrowing, like a door being closed. "I see no reason why one should not invite them to a party," he answered coldly. "Oh, I didn't mean to criticize your choice of guests, but, well, I've been trying not to learn which one of them is Bertram Scudder. If I do, I'll slap his face." She tried to sound casual. "I don't want to create a scene, but I'm not sure I'll be able to control myself. I couldn't believe it when somebody told me that Mrs. Reardon had invited him. I invited him. But..." Then her voice dropped. "Why?" "I don't attach any importance to occasions of this kind." "I'm sorry, Hank. I didn't know you were so tolerant. I'm not." He said nothing.